please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. On February 16th, 2024, the FDA announced the approval of the first biologic to treat patients with food allergy, omalizumab. In this first part of a two-part series, we will review the evidence behind the omalizumab as monotherapy and as adjunct therapy to multi-allergen OIT and food allergic children and adult study, or OUtMATCH, that led to this FDA indication. In the next episode, we'll have part two, where we'll discuss important considerations in implementing omalizumab for food allergy in your practice. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. We're very fortunate today to be joined by two investigators in the OUtMATCH trial who can help us understand the study's background, design, outcomes, and future directions. Our first guest is Dr. Robert Wood, the Julie and Neil Reinhardt Professor of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology and Division Director at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is also the primary investigator of the OUtMATCH study. Bob, thank you so much for joining us on Allergy Talk.
It's my pleasure, Jerry. Happy to do it.
Wonderful. And our second guest is Dr. Brian Vickery, the Marcus Professor of Pediatric Immunology and the Division Chief, and my boss, at Emory University and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. He is one of the site investigators of the OUtMATCH study. Brian, thanks again for coming back to Allergy Talk.
Thanks for the invitation, Jerry. Thanks, Bob, for joining, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, let's get started. Bob, we're recording this podcast just a few days after the Academy meeting, where you announced the results of years of work on the OUtMATCH trial to a standing ovation. First, I want to express my congratulations to you, Sharon, Brian, the rest of the OUtMATCH team for this stunning achievement. I know this has been a project that you've been working on for years. How are you feeling? Describe how this month and week has been for you.
It's an important week for me personally, but more so for our patients. And I think the announcement at the Academy meeting was great. The really important announcement, though, happened, as you said, on February 16th, where the FDA approved this for our patients. So it was beyond exciting that these happened almost simultaneously. But I'm still going to go back to say that the goal of this study from the start was to bring this drug to our patients. And that FDA approval was actually what was most meaningful to me.
So as you mentioned, they just happened right next to each other. So Brian, what did the FDA actually announce about the new label or indication for omalizumab?
Well, I'm actually going to just quote it verbatim. So what the label says is that omalizumab is indicated for IgE-mediated food allergy in adult and pediatric patients aged 1 year and older for the reduction of allergic reactions. And here we're talking about immediate hypersensitivity reactions, including anaphylaxis, that may occur with accidental exposure to one or more foods, to be used in conjunction with food allergen avoidance. That's the label indication that the FDA approved for omalizumab.
And so in the next episode, we absolutely will see how that's implemented, but we have to really understand what's the evidence behind this drug. And I think the OUtMATCH trial really helps us understand that and we can review the evidence for this. So Bob, let's start from the beginning. When we set out to do OUtMATCH, what was your overall goals and research questions?
The question's been on my mind for a long time. And there was evidence back really to the time this drug was approved for asthma in 2003 that it might work for food allergy. And the background was, in the interim, there were a couple of dozen of small studies that really strongly suggested that this drug could be very useful in food allergy. And all those small studies actually don't add up to anything when it comes to the FDA and bringing this to our patients. So this study was specifically designed with a singular intent to do the right study to get an FDA label. And it was the results were not surprising. I kind of knew it would work, but it really took a massive collaboration to bring this forward.
Let's talk about the collaboration. Could you tell us about the structure of OUtMATCH, the leaders, the clinical sites, and even your collaborators?
Yeah, so it's actually a pretty unique collaboration. And this opportunity began in 2017 when I became the lead of COFAR, Consortium for Food Allergy Research. And we were at that point designing new trials to do in the 7-year grant period. And many, many ideas were put forward. This idea of studying omalizumab sort of rose to the top. And the unique collaboration was that this was a joint effort between the NIH and COFAR working for the NIH and industry in a unique way. And what I mean by unique is that we've done lots of studies at the NIH where companies have collaborated in terms of like providing product. And we've done lots of pharmaceutical sponsored studies where the pharma company actually runs the show. And the unique thing here is that this was a complete collaboration that included industry, NIH, and COFAR. The next collaborator really was the FDA. And at the beginning of developing the protocol, we started developing the protocol in 2017. We didn't launch the study until 2019. And it took that long to get everyone on the same page. And that included the discussions with the FDA in terms of what are the kinds of things that they would be looking for, really requiring to even consider a label. And we may talk, you know, badly about the FDA sometimes, but in this context, they really do a very valuable service in terms of thinking about a product and our patients. And that process wasn't without a few bumps in the road, but it was still a very productive collaboration. Then we decided that we had our COFAR sites. We needed a few more sites. We decided on 10 sites total to be able to accomplish this study. And we finally got the study off the ground in August of 2019.
And we'll talk about the challenges of 2019 in a second. But let's talk about the actual entry criteria and who was actually included in this study. Brian, could you tell us about the study population and especially any important exclusions we should be aware of?
Yeah, so the data are now all online at the New England Journal. And so for interested listeners, the entire study protocol is published in the online supplement at nejm.org. And if you're interested, you can go and see the whole thing, the statistical analysis plan, all of it. But I'll summarize the key criteria. And I think the most important thing is, look, this is a multi-food allergic population, right? Which is, you could have done a peanut study with omalizumab, but this is a multi-food allergic population. So these are individuals aged 1 to 55 with a history of allergy to peanut and then at least two other protocol-specified non-peanut foods in a list among six. So this is milk, egg, wheat, cashew, walnut, hazelnut. So these participants had eligible test results at screening for skin tests, serum IgE tests, and challenges. And I would note that there is a key difference for peanut and non-peanut foods that will probably come up later. So in terms of baseline eligibility criteria. So for peanut, you had to have a skin test of at least 4 millimeters mean wheel diameter above the negative control and a serum-specific IgE for peanut of at least 6. And you had to react at or before 100 milligrams of peanut protein in an entry food challenge. So for milk, egg, or wheat, you had to have the same testing parameters, skin test of at least 4 and serum IgE of at least 6, but there the qualifying threshold was dose-limiting symptoms at or before 300 milligrams of protein in the entry challenge. And then for the tree nuts, cashew, hazel, and walnut, you had to have either the skin test over 4 or the specific IgE of at least 6 and dose-limiting symptoms at or before 300 milligrams of peanut protein. And the reason that decision was made is, I think it was, we all know in clinical practice, you have patients who react to tree nuts, who may have a significant reaction and may have quite a large skin test, but then sort of an unexpectedly low IgE level, this sort of discordant result between the skin test and the IgE level. And we didn't think it was, you know, appropriate to exclude those kinds of participants from the study. Now, of course, they didn't react to the placebo challenge, and it's important to think about how these challenges were done. So here we're talking about at least 4 blinded challenges at screening. So 3 to their allergenic foods, and then 1 interspersed placebo challenge, all conducted blinded in random order and on different days. And now some of the participants may have had even more than 2 potentially qualifying non-peanut foods that could be considered sort of backup foods for eligibility. And there was an allowance in the protocol for these individuals, if they had reacted to peanut and not placebo and still needed a non-peanut food or two to qualify, could move on to their backup list of foods. So some might have even had more than four challenges. And in these cases, the sites worked with each family on an individual basis to determine which of the non-peanut foods were the priority foods and which were the backup foods and so on. This wasn't a lot of participants, but there was an extensive process to characterize these individuals at baseline. They also were required to have a body weight and a serum IgE level suitable for omalizumab dosing based on the dosing algorithm and nomogram that we have been using for asthma that have been modified for this study. We could talk later about what those modifications are, but you know, it was based on weight and total IgE. And then fairly conventional exclusion criteria, poorly controlled or severe asthma or atopic dermatitis, according to sort of the usual definitions. A history of severe anaphylaxis, that is truly life-threatening anaphylaxis to one of the protocol's specified foods, defined as neurological compromise or intubation. Previous immunotherapy for any of the protocol's specified foods or monoclonal antibody therapy within 6 months of screening. History of eosinophilic GI disease in the three-year period prior to screening. Past or current history of cancer. Recent study participation. And then the usual kind of in the investigator's discretion, any other chronic disease, physical finding, lab abnormality, or so forth that could affect safe participation in the study.
That is quite a list. And, you know, I just wanted to repeat some of those key points here, where these are patients who have at least three food allergies and need to do four blinded challenges to investigate that. And Bob, going back to 2019, as you know, 2019 is the year before the start of the pandemic. I can only imagine the challenges to even get this label through the pandemic on all these occasions. Bob, can you speak to the recruitment experience and executing the study in the middle of COVID-19?
I can. There were many, many obstacles to recruitment before and after the pandemic. And it began really with first finding people who are that allergic to that many foods. We see them in practice, but you could see somebody and you thought they cough easily, but they just weren't as allergic as we thought. Mm. The second is, when you really sign your child up for this study that's going to have multiple food challenges, with a 1/3 chance you can be treated with placebo, undergo food challenges again, where you have the potential of severe reactions. So we had to screen, Jerry, 435 patients to randomize 180.
Ooh.
The actual screening number, the screen failure rate, was much higher than that because we pre-screened a lot of people before they were screened for the study. Hmm. So one of the worries we have about recruitment and actually implementing Xolair in practice is that if your Ig level is too high, you get knocked out of eligibility. And we basically, our different clinical sites, took the opportunity to pre-screen to make sure that some didn't walk in with an Ig level of 3,000 because they just weren't going to qualify.
Right.
Yeah, back to the COVID thing. The COVID piece, it was a disaster. It was also one of the highlights of the study, and I'll tell you why it was a highlight. When the study was shut down in April of 2020, and at that point, we had 42% participants getting injections. They were either in the beginning part of stage one or open label extension. Some of them were as far as 7 months into their injections, and all 42 came back and started over.
Incredible.
And this, we all know, is a tribute to our study staff, our study coordinators. And, you know, I actually said this in the talk at the Academy meeting. My study staff, they were getting love notes from kids saying, I miss you so much. Can I come back? I want to start my shots again. And no one left the study during COVID. Now, there were certainly people who were reluctant to come into a medical setting for the next year or two. So we can't really quantify how large that obstacle was. But we certainly know that to think, especially with younger children, I'm going to bring my child into your research unit every 2 weeks, almost forever, was certainly an obstacle. But we did overcome that.
Brian, any other anecdotes from the Atlanta site?
No, I mean, I think that was our experience. We all had the same experience. We had to comb through a lot of charts. We had to have a lot of conversations with families. You know, COVID aside, when Bob first approached me about participating in the study, and it was such an opportunity to be a part of this, you know, thing that we all sensed would change practice, you know, if we were successful in carrying it off. But you kind of look at the protocol and you think, wow, this is a lot to do. We're asking a lot out of these participants, and we have to get them through this, reacting to all three foods at these thresholds, which are hard to predict in advance. You can have somebody that has a very convincing history, but you don't necessarily know that they're going to react at or before 100 or 300 milligrams. And yet you've got to get them through that, you know, three times. And so you'd have ones where they'd have a reaction to one or two foods, and you'd get to the third one and you can't get the third one through. And those are the most agonizing kinds of screen failures that you'd have. But we all sort of knew that that was a possibility going into it. And yet the sites were incredible in doing this painstaking work to identify these participants, answer all their questions. The consent document is many, many pages long, help the families understand this, and then get them in through the screening process. And again, like outside of COVID, that would have been a big enough challenge. And then you layer COVID into it in the middle of it. And it goes back to what Bob said, which is really that you're hearing from the two of us on the podcast and you see the paper published with the authorship, but really the engine that made all this happen were the site staff and coordinators who were building these relationships with these families, because it just took hours and hours and hours of work on their part. And the families learned to trust them and they were able to kind of guide them through this very complex and challenging study. And here we are.
Wonderful. That's fantastic. And so we eventually made it to the finish line. Just so everyone's on the same page, how was the intervention performed and what were you measuring to prove that omalizumab was effective?
So the intervention was injections given either every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks based on the dosing algorithm for 16 to 20 weeks. And the outcome is fairly straightforward, very complicated, but fairly straightforward and really based on food challenge outcomes. And you were required to be deemed a success to have changed your reaction threshold on the post-treatment food challenge to a level that, again, was predefined and pre-agreed upon with the FDA. So basically for peanut, just to use that example, as Brian said, you had to react to 100 milligram dose. That's 144 milligrams cumulatively. And then to be called a success, you had to tolerate at least 600 milligrams of peanut. 1,044 milligrams cumulatively. So it was a fairly high bar, but one that has been used in some other studies. For the other foods where they had different entry criteria, you then had to tolerate a 1,000 milligram dose. We made a few mistakes, maybe, because we did think it would be impossible to recruit enough people who would all be as reactive as they were for peanut. But it turned out for all the foods, their initial reacting dose was very similar. And it turned out that for cashew, it was even lower. Mm-hmm. So some of the cashew allergy, the average dose it caused for cashew was 10 milligrams. People were reacting at 10 milligrams on average, and they had to get up to 1,000 milligrams to be called a success. But we still met the benchmark for all of the foods.
So yeah, let's go right into the results. First, obviously, we have a very selected population here due to the multi-food. Could you describe who actually was enrolled in the study? Anything that stands out when you look at like a table one?
I think the most important things are a very even representation of age groups up through pediatrics. We were required by the FDA to have at least 50 participants age 5 and below. This was really unique to this study because this drug has not been approved for any indication below the age of 6. There is lots of safety information on Xolair for older children, adolescents, and adults. There was none for younger children. And we had an equal number, 68 in the 1 to 5-year-olds, and then an equal number in the 5 to 11, and equal in the 12 to 17. So that was very comforting to me. Now, the FDA did not require that we enrolled any adults, even though we were allowed to enroll adults. And we only had 3 adults in the entire study population. Going into this FDA process, that was actually a worry to most of us that they wouldn't be satisfied. Brian knows all too well from his clinical trial experience that they may be looking for a certain number of adults to grant approval for that age group. And they were, though, convinced that the pathophysiology of food allergy really shouldn't be different if you're 6 or 16 or 26 or 36. And that was the argument that led them to give approval, again, age 1 and above.
Oh, so that's interesting. So even though there are very few adults, just based on our experience and how the drug works, we were able to extend it and allow other people access. So that's a wonderful opportunity. And I guess it would be so challenging to get that equal number of adults as well to further increase the complexity of the study. What a relief.
Believe me, Jerry, we were planning our adult study. We actually said we probably have to have an adult study. So thankfully, we can move on to bigger and better things, including more studies on omalizumab.
All right. Well, how did they do, Bob, with the primary outcome?
So the primary outcome, again, was just based on peanut, that everyone in the study had to be allergic to peanuts. So we set it up that way to make sure we had an adequate sample size. And the answer is that 67% on active drug reached a primary endpoint compared to 6.7% on placebo. And the results were very similar for all the other foods except cashew, which did turn out to be harder to treat. The other sort of thing hidden within the data, though, is does our definition of success mean the same thing for everybody and for every food? And the truth is that it does not. So let's say you were one of these cashew people who reacted to 3 milligrams at baseline, and you tolerated 600 milligrams post-treatment. You were not a success. Your life is totally different. You have this enormous amount of protection for cashew, but you were not considered a success. So our subsequent papers will sort of try to contextualize this a little bit more clearly. The New England Journal allows for no contextualization. You really can't tell a story at all, and that's totally fine. It's a very, very rigid format, but we will have the opportunity in subsequent studies to really look more at other sort of things that from a clinical standpoint, and that's the beauty of this, we're now back in the clinic, what you might consider a success for your individual patients.
So those are really impressive results. But as you know, I'm very curious about the ones who did not reach the primary outcome. And as we offer to the patients, is there any guidance to know who are the patients who may not actually get the protection from this drug? Brian, do we know anything about predictors of response or lack of response to omalizumab?
Well, so I'll take first crack at this, and then I would love to hear from Bob too. And I'll try not to get too technical and kind of on a tangent here, but the way that the endpoint was reported is the proportion of those able to achieve at least a minimum tolerated dose in the exit food challenge, which is the way it's conventionally reported, right? So that's the responder percentage. So you heard what those were, 67% for peanut. But the other way to look at the data is to look at the actual trajectory pre to post. How did you do? And so when you're looking at the effect size, listeners could go to supplementary figure 3 in the online, which shows the individual trajectories of all the participants in the study and for each of the foods. So you can actually see how everybody changed when you're trying to look at this question of the degree of response, even in those who may not have had such a great response. And that gives you additional information beyond just what percentage was able to tolerate at least 600. So for instance, you know, you could look at that and say, well, 600 milligrams is 1044 in terms of cumulative protein exposure, and 67% in the peanut group was able to tolerate that much. But if you ask, what is the median MTD? I was actually 4044. I was 2 dose steps higher than that on average, right? And you can look at that for all the different foods. Now, when you do this, as Bob said, cashew stands out. We can talk more about cashew, but you have a fuller characterization of how people change. And you'll see that there, some of the non-responders are just frankly subject to the pre-specified definitions that were set up on how we define treatment response, as Bob alluded to. So you can have somebody who changes 100-fold and isn't counted, depending on what their sort of their baseline MTD was. And that was the case for cashew, for instance. I mean, like the baseline MTD that the screening food challenge was 10 milligrams for cashew, but they had to get to 1,000 to be considered a treatment responder. So that's a 100-fold increase, which is a higher bar than we had for others. So there were a small number of folks who didn't seem to change much, even in a clinically meaningful way. Right. So there are those that, like the hypothetical participant Bob described earlier, would be a big change, would be clinically meaningful, but not be considered a treatment responder. There were a few who just didn't seem to change a lot. And we've actually seen that in other omalizumab studies too. Oh, yet who these individuals are and why this happens, if it's related to their biology or something else. And, you know, that's an important question that we need to address in future analyses and future work. There have been a number of studies looking at clinical, biological, other kinds of parameters that would help you decide or understand the patient in front of me is or is not likely to do well when we start this drug. And I will kick it over to Bob because I'd love to hear, you know, kind of his thoughts on where those predictor analyses are, what we've learned from them, and kind of where we need to go next.
So in the initial analysis area, we took a look at sort of the obvious clinical and biomarker aspects that might predict response. And the short story is we saw very little. And we didn't see, say, a relationship between your food challenge at baseline, your chance of responding. And we can promise a paper in the next 6 months or so that really takes a deep, deep dive into these predictors, because the most important question for our patients and our colleagues take care of these patients is this a good candidate or not?
Right.
And right now, there are going to be some definitions that may make a good candidate. You'll talk with Dr. Chintaraja about, but they're not going to be based right now on laboratory characteristics.
Okay. Just as a side note, I did notice that 4 patients in the placebo group also reached the primary outcome, so technically didn't need the drug. I'm just curious if we know anything about those patients.
We can make some presumptions about those patients. Their lab results all fit the criteria. They had every chance of being allergic. My belief is none of them were actually allergic. And the way this can happen, and any allergist doing food challenges can understand this, what I believe happened is that when you're doing your qualifying challenges, we're putting these kids, teenagers, and any age group through a lot. So let's say, Jerry, you have a 3-year-old here, and they came in on Monday, and they just had a miserable reaction to peanut, and they came in on Wednesday and did the same thing for walnut. They come back in the next day and do it for egg. And the next time they come in and get placebo, this 3-year-old says, "Miss Maureen, my stomach hurts really bad. I can't take another dose." And the vagaries of a food challenge is that you have to be able to try to interpret these subjective symptoms. And I think there were kids who came into the study who just were not allergic. But we'll never be able to prove that.
Sure. I mean, of course. And we do the best we can with double-blind placebo control trials. We mentioned the cashew story multiple times. So Brian, could you just give us a little bit more detail on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a question that comes up when you look at the data. What I would say is, so peanut, you've heard, is the primary endpoint. Milk, egg, and cashew were pre-specified key secondary endpoints, which means that the analyses for the outcomes for those 3 other non-peanut foods were statistically controlled rigorously to guard against a spurious p-value related to multiple comparisons. So there's a procedure to evaluate those with alpha spend and so on. And when you look at those key secondaries for milk, egg, and cashew, milk and egg look almost identical to peanut in terms of the response rate. Cashew looks a little different. My explanation for that, at least part of the answer, again, is this study design issue, where for very legitimate reasons, the decision to allow non-peanut thresholds at entry was increased to 300, because if we had kept them all at 100 for all the foods, it would just become untenable. The screen fail rate would have been 80% or something, you know? So,
okay.
And obviously thresholds are different for different foods, you know, for egg, for instance. And so because of that, because they were allowed in the study at 300 milligrams, they then had to achieve 1,000 milligrams to be considered a responder, where peanut was 100 and 600. And in retrospect, at least for cashew, we could have kept it at 100, because cashew patients were exquisitely sensitive at entry, actually a little bit more sensitive than peanut. As I said before, their MTD was 10 on average. And so as a result, they had to clear a higher bar. They had to have this 100-fold improvement to be considered a responder. And so that sort of put those cashew analyses at sort of a disadvantage, because they were held to a different standard than others. But the one thing I would also say about cashew that is somewhat unique, that stands out, is the first 60 participants to exit stage 1 went into an open label extension, where they got 6 months of open label omalizumab and then got challenged again. And you can see the results of those challenges in the manuscript as well. And for most of the foods, what you see is that there's a robust response at the end of stage 1 after 16 or 20 weeks of treatment. And then 6 months later, the additional improvement is modest. In other words, they're at least as good as they were at the end of stage 1, maybe a little better, but the effect sort of saturates because the stage 1 effect is so strong. With cashew, what you see is improvement, which is still statistically significant and clinically important for cashew, even as a secondary endpoint at the end of stage one. It's lower, it's 42%, but it's still a big change. And then when you look with 6 more months of treatment for cashew, that MTD increases quite a bit. So now at the end of the open label extension, the participants are tolerating as much cashew as they're tolerating the other foods at the end of the open label extension.
So it takes a little bit longer.
Maybe. Which suggests to me that it may not be inherently more difficult to treat or more reactive. It just may take a little bit more time.
All right. So Bob, let's talk about the future. You know, we're obviously going to learn a lot from this study. What can allergists and immunologists look forward to with the later stages of OutMatch?
So we designed a study that was probably far too complicated, but we can at least say we're going to try to answer every question that somebody might have about the use of this drug. And the stage one was a very straightforward double-blind placebo-controlled comparison of drug to placebo. Stage two, it gets more complicated in that it is a comparison of 52 more weeks of omalizumab, or 52 weeks, you didn't have to be on omalizumab in stage one, compared to multi-food OIT. And, you know, our specialty has still a lot to learn about optimal treatment for one patient versus another. So we will have, and the last patient in stage two will finish in August of this year. So by the end of this year, we will hopefully have those data to say, as we get hopefully toward a little bit more personalized kind of medicine, are there candidates who really will do better on one form of therapy or another? We also gave the multi-food OIT under the protection of omalizumab. So everyone got 8 weeks before they started and 8 weeks after they started. So we tried to kind of level the playing field so that there would be every potential for each of the therapies to work. Then the third stage is going to be most fun of all. And the third stage was really designed to say, after you've been treated, either with omalizumab or with multi-food OIT, what is the likelihood that you can actually start eating that food? And in stage three, if you had enough protection at the end of stage two or at the end of the open label extension, you were permitted to start eating your allergenic foods. And this is something that may change the landscape a little bit clinically, maybe a lot clinically. It's not going to change the FDA label ever. But we certainly saw, because we become unblinded once we sit there and watch them eat some ice cream, became unlimited to stage three, we saw some amazing successes. And that stage three will not be done until 2026. So be patient. It's a long, long study, but that we'll have a lot more information about other ways that omalizumab might benefit certain patients above and beyond what will be on the FDA label.
I think the entire community is going to be immensely impatient to hear about these results. Thank you so much, both of you, for sharing your experiences, trying to explain it to the allergy immunology community. I would just love for both of you just to take one moment and tell me, like, maybe one thing else we have not discussed that you think you learned from the trial. Brian, let's start with you. What's one thing we didn't mention that you think you learned?
Well, one takeaway or sort of reflection for me would be that this is a paradigm shift, right? I mean, this is an inflection point. To me, this really kind of reshuffles the deck. And this is the goal, right? Like, and the mechanism of action of this particular medication and this approach, this is sort of what we were shooting for. But compared to like our previous experience, the large scale phase three type trials that we've done in the past have been in one form of immunotherapy or another, which are different. You know, you're applying the treatment usually daily, and it's got allergenic material in it, and people have adverse events related to allergen exposure, and you're treating one allergen at a time, and you have a fair amount of treatment withdrawal or treatment non-responsiveness related to immunotherapy. And here you have a biologic treatment that doesn't have allergen in it that was very well tolerated in the study. I mean, the safety data, we haven't even talked about the safety data. The safety data are very reassuring. They get the dose every 2 or 4 weeks. In that sense, this is a paradigm that we use in the clinic for asthma, and we're used to doing that, but it's just not been something we've done in food allergy. There was very high retention in the study. Very few people left the study. You heard about the 42 that came back after COVID. And then you do these food challenges, and the results are completely different than they were at the beginning. And they're, for a lot of patients, they're completely different for multiple foods. And I mean, the impact on the families, there were tears a lot of the time. The outcomes for these participants, when they saw how much they could tolerate compared to where they were before, and for multiple things, in a scheme, a treatment scheme that was fairly well tolerated, especially compared to the alternative immunotherapy, just a completely different kind of experience than in other previous trials. And that's the thing that I'll sort of take away.
Bob, do you want to add anything to that?
I could go on a long time. Just be very brief about it. So the thing I'm most pleased about is going down to age one and including adults. And while we've been talking about this drug to our patients saying we're doing this study, there are tears in the clinic saying this is amazing. But to be able to go down that young and to be able to give our college students the benefit of this drug is really going to be a game changer. And the last thing I'll say, Jerry, is that this unique collaboration that I mentioned in the beginning shouldn't go unnoticed. And as we design our next set of trials for COFAR, we really have this model in mind that if you can bring together industry, not just as giving us the drug, but as thought leaders, along with the investigators, along with the expert at the NIH, along with the regulatory folks at the NIH, and you know, really set out with a well-designed goal, something like this can be done.
Well, yes. Again, a very exciting development. As again, paradigm shift, as you're saying, Brian, we are so grateful for the work y'all have done and the best, especially the patients who've donated their time and moved the field forward. Thank you so much for joining us on Allergy Talk and all the hard work you've done and improving the lives of our patients.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
If you've liked what you heard today, please rate our podcast on iTunes. It's very helpful. And you may have a lot of questions that's come up about the OutMatch study. If you have any questions or have ideas for a future episode, please email your feedback at allergytalk1word@acaai.org. And to read archive issues of Allergy Watch, head over to our website at college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. The ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice or intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that might be referenced. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Dr. Lee has nothing to disclose. Dr. Wood has received consulting fees from Genentech. Dr. Vickery has received consulting fees from Genentech and Novartis.